Ladies and gentlemen, I am Matt Belinsky, and this is The Prevailing Narrative. Today, I'm joined by David Sachs. David is a noted entrepreneur and venture capitalist, formerly COO of PayPal, founder CEO of Yammer, and currently general partner of Kraft Ventures. He's also the co-host of the All In podcast and is quickly becoming one of America's most prominent thought leaders and commentators, speaking vocally on matters ranging from politics and world affairs to business and culture. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good to be here. That was quite an intro.
I didn't know that
we had gotten that much attention, but I guess the All In Pod is kind of growing in popularity. So
it is. And well, I think what's interesting is that as the American discourse kind of becomes more three-dimensional with people who are also wanted to speak on business and the startup world, but also getting involved in politics and world affairs. I think, you know, you guys have kind of led the way, and the audience is now kind of following and matching that. So I think that's why postulating on its success recently, but it's been fantastic. And so one topic that you've been kind of keenly focused on for a while now is online speech and censorship, both in terms of its freedom of speech implications, but also as a signal for a kind of creeping de facto social credit system almost being enacted by a number of the big tech companies. So obviously, we're in the middle of a transformational event in this realm with Elon buying Twitter. Twitter founder Jack Dorsey called Elon the singular solution I trust. So okay, if Elon is the solution, and we'll get to that in a second, what is the problem? In your words, how would you describe the problem that you have noticed that you've been kind of, you know, the canary in the coal mine on in terms of censorship, impositions on free speech, and this kind of soft authoritarianism of a social credit system in America the last few years?
Yeah, well, I think the thing to understand about this wave of censorship is the enormous inertia that it had behind it until Elon stepped up and said, stop. First, you know, going back several years, you had sort of cases of isolated individuals being thrown off social media. But everyone said, no, those are just isolated cases or provocateurs or unpopular people. It was a Milo Yiannopoulos or an Alex Jones. But then it kept growing. More and more people kept getting thrown off until a sitting president of the United States was deplatformed a couple of years ago. Then the censorship started taking place against entire categories of thought and opinion. We saw during COVID that if you had the wrong opinion on the efficacy of vaccines or cloth masks or where the virus might have come from, you could be censored, thrown off social media for that, even though a lot of those opinions later turned out to be true. Mm-hmm. Now, that idea of censoring categories of thought is being applied to things like climate change and to gender identity. Look, whatever your positions are on these issues, my problem with it is that we are basically silencing entire categories of thought here, and we're declaring these debates to be over. As if there's nothing more we can ever learn. There's no fact. Everything has been discovered and figured out. That is simply not the case. And this would have kept going. I mean, does anybody think that this would have stopped here? No, of course not. More and more categories of thought were being outlawed. It was positively Orwellian. Mm-hmm. And it really felt like all of us were sort of putty in the Orwellian hands of these content moderators, these censors, and our right to free speech was being taken away. And that's why I think what Elon has done is really important. He's basically come along and said, stop. You know, this has gone far enough. We need to restore Twitter to being the town square, the open town square. We need to stop censoring people based on, wrongthink. And so that's where we are right now. And so therefore, it's been one of the first positive things to happen in that domain for several years now.
No doubt. And beyond just the actual censorship, and I think people might have been focusing on that too much, is actual censorship there was, self-censorship outnumbered that, you know, any order of magnitude, is that people self-censoring, not expressing certain ideas, values, or points of view for fear of backlash or more formal censorship, I think is the unspoken issue that was even more significant. And in looking at how Elon is addressing this, I mean, another, you know, big tech name, Mark Andreessen, tweeted out, overheard in Silicon Valley, we've had decades of preference falsification in corporate America. Turns out when Elon stands up and says, this is absurd, a lot of people have courage to do the same. So preference falsification, essentially, a lot of people, that most people are out there lying. They're lying about what their points of view are in order to either one, gain social credibility, or two, avoid social censure. And to how prominent do you think an issue that issue was, and how much do you think that played into, you know, that drove what's happening now with Elon leading the way and solving it?
Yeah, I think it's a very serious issue, because if you know that stating the wrong opinion, and you're not sure exactly what the wrong opinions are, you just have this general sense of, you know, what you're not allowed to say. If stating the wrong opinion all of a sudden can get you thrown off social media, it can get you depersoned, or worse, you could lose access to your financial accounts. We should talk about that in a second. Sure. Of course, it's going to have a chilling effect on the discourse. And that basically is, you know, when I was in college, we called this political correctness. Now it's, you know, it's called woke. Yep. What we've seen over the last several years is that people would get canceled. They would lose their jobs for expressing the wrong opinion on social media. And, you know, and that's part of it, too. So you have this sort of these forces of cancellation and censorship. And it's getting to the point where a lot of Americans feel like they don't have the right to say what they really think. And this is just fundamentally un-American. You know, the First Amendment is first for a reason. It's one of our most fundamental values. You know, we have the freedom of speech. It's just one of the most fundamental birthrights we have as Americans. And I think a lot of people feel like it's being infringed and taken away.
And as it's being infringed, in a point that you've made recently in terms, because it almost feels like it's reductive to just describe it as freedom of speech, right? Because people get lost in the shuffle there, in that people start using counter arguments as if anyone who believes in freedom of speech means anything goes, but that's clearly right. Not the case. Freedom of speech, as it's understood to be, has been filtered through the American legal system now for a couple hundred years. There are contours to this. There are limitations, and this is a point you made recently in a Bloomberg interview. And that, listen, to the extent that you know there can be unprotected speech, we've already, the American court system and even culturally have determined that. And I think that was a really good point that you made.
Yeah, exactly. So this is probably the single biggest mischaracterization about freedom of speech, is that it means anything goes. The Supreme Court has, over the last 230 years, been looking at hard cases, or, you know, hard First Amendment cases, to figure out what are the boundaries of free speech. And the Supreme Court has actually found that there's 9 categories of speech that are not protected by the First Amendment, mm-hmm. because that type of speech is dangerous. I mean, this is the proverbial yelling fire in a crowded theater type of idea, but that's sort of a sort of a cliche. But the categories are things like fraud, right? You can't defraud somebody and then claim, mm-hmm. well, I got to defraud someone because that speech was protected. Incitement to commit a crime, to commit violence, to incite imminent lawless action. That is not protected speech. Harassing people or stalking someone, that's, you know, it's not protected. There is a Supreme Court case called Chaplinsky, in which fighting words, which are basically ethnic and racial slurs, it said that is not protected speech. So this idea, you know, you hear this idea a lot, that if Elon restores free speech to Twitter, that it's going to become a cesspool of people mm-hmm. using racial and ethnic slurs. And my point would be, that's not what the First Amendment means. The Twitter could have a content moderation policy that's grounded in the First Amendment, in First Amendment case law. And we look to the Supreme Court for the categories of speech that you're not allowed to say, or that's not protected. You wouldn't be able to use these slurs. You wouldn't be able to incite violence. You wouldn't be able to harass people or commit fraud. So you could basically have a content moderation policy that's rooted in First Amendment principles. And the benefit of that would be that you're not just making it up as you go along. Mm-hmm. What's happening right now is that the content moderators, these social networks, are basically implementing speech restrictions in an extremely ad hoc way, and in an extremely partisan way. It's not even-handed. Completely arbitrary. They're not making it up. They're just making it up as they go along. Mm-hmm. And then there's no transparency around this either.
Yep.
So one of the things that Elon said that would make a lot of sense is, listen, if we are going to take an action to restrict your speech, you're entitled to know why. Mm-hmm. You know, and what he said is, I want to open source the algorithm. So what he's saying is, if there's going to be a restriction on your account, we need to know, was that the algorithm that did it? Mm-hmm. Was that a human intervention that did it? And why did it happen? And so bringing transparency to this whole process would be good. Right now, again, we live in this Orwellian world where you post something on social media and all of a sudden your account gets suspended.
Yeah.
And you don't even know why.
Yeah. And now that's what I've always been harping on, is that, okay, if you want the ability to ban everybody, there should at least be some guardrail there in terms of due process. And how, I mean, you know, you are keenly aware of what it's like to operate a tech company that services hundreds and hundreds of millions of customers. But isn't it weird? I mean, there's very few companies on the face of the earth that you cannot reach a human flesh and blood representative of. You cannot reach, you aren't reaching anybody. You're not getting a phone call from Twitter. You are not getting a phone call from Facebook and Instagram. I mean, Twitter's actually even been a little more forthcoming in its description and explanation to people who have had their accounts taken down. Instagram and Facebook, you're just, you get, hey, here's how you appeal. You'll send that appeal. It's a, you throw it into a Kafka-esque hole. And it seems right. Like this should be some sort, there should be some sort of due process where, and they have the money for it. Like if you're a platform of a certain size that has a certain, it reaches a certain threshold of users, okay, you're going to have to go and hire a number of representatives to at least field calls and communicate the explanations for why someone has been censored or had their account suspended or terminated. I mean, am I completely off base here? Does it seem like that's a pretty reasonable requirement?
I think it is a reasonable requirement. I think that is what they should do. Part of why it's difficult is because what happens is when they implement these speech restrictions, let's say there's a category of speech where you're not allowed to have an opinion. They have to then create guidelines around that. Well, what exactly does it mean to have an opinion on climate change that's not acceptable? What does it mean to have an opinion on cloth masks or vaccines or what have you that's not acceptable to them, right?
Yeah.
So they then start publishing these internal guidelines, and then they have these giant, they have to operationalize it somehow. So they have these giant departments of content moderators. And quite frankly, you're getting into hundreds or even thousands of employees doing this, and it becomes a giant cost center. So they start outsourcing it to what are called BPOs or business process organizations, who are third party vendors basically who run large operational processes. So they hand these guidelines to these BPOs. The BPOs frequently aren't even in the US because it's a lot cheaper to basically hire BPOs in countries like Philippines or India or whatever. And so now you've got these BPOs trying to navigate these Byzantine cultural hot buttons that we have and discern what is correct speech and then apply these things to specific tweets or posts on Facebook. It absolutely is unworkable. It makes no sense. And this is why you get, you know, events like, I don't know if you remember a few months ago, Ron Paul got thrown off Facebook for saying something, and you know, maybe they interpreted it as violence or something like that. And of course, as soon as they found out that it was Ron Paul and his son is a sitting US senator, they said, oh, sorry, we made a mistake. It was just an accident, right? But, and I don't think they intended to censor Ron Paul. I just think that when you try to operationalize these extremely Byzantine speech restrictions, you end up with a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
But the rest of us don't have a son who's sitting in the US Senate, who's powerful, who can get Facebook to basically reverse their restriction on our account and say it was a mistake. The rest of us just have our accounts frozen.
Yeah.
So this is the place we've arrived at. And it would be a lot better off, I think we'd all be a lot better off if we had a simpler content moderation policy. It was, again, rooted in simple First Amendment principles. And therefore, you didn't have all of these crazy Byzantine requirements that get placed on users that then have to be implemented through these content moderation departments.
I want to, you know, pose you a question regarding the terminology around this issue. The terms disinformation and misinformation, how often did we hear about those terms before 2016? Almost never. Now it's like we've come with, up with this new Orwellian speak for trying to justify content moderation, right? What happened one day when it became wrong to describe something as simply false or inaccurate,
right?
And now it's got to be termed disinformation and misinformation as seemingly to give it more in a more sinister tone to it. I mean, what do you is this? Maybe I guess what I'm asking is this just Trump? Is this all that the people operating who work for or who work for these tech companies or those who are relevant, you know, are in that sphere and comment on it, were so traumatized by the fact that Donald Trump used these platforms to elevate him, you know, a populist movement that many people found very offensive and dangerous, used these tools to slingshot himself into the White House, that they just abandoned every principle, and that the overarching goal, everything became, became lower priority to preventing that from ever happening again. Is that really what this all goes back to?
Yeah. I mean, here's what I think happened is that there is one type of disinformation that I think would be legitimate to regulate and keep off social networks, which is when an account is not who they purport to be and is running a large scale operation of fake accounts or bots, spam accounts, basically, in order to create a misperception. So, for example, you know, this is basically what the Russians are accused of, is the FSB supposedly was running a large scale operation on Facebook to, you know, where you've got accounts who are pretending to be some guy in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And it's actually like a foreign government. OK, I think we can all agree that should be taken down. Why? Because the account is not authentic. It's not who it purports to be. Mm-hmm. And I think it would make sense for social networks to have some sort of authenticity requirement. And Elon has said, the first thing I'm going to do is get rid of these bots and spam accounts. I mean, Twitter is just rife with spam right now. Mm-hmm. And you can see all these fake accounts. So,
yeah.
And I think he'll do a better job doing that than Twitter, because Twitter's current management has, because he's got all these AI researchers at Tesla who are like top notch at this. Mm-hmm. And I think they can basically win the arms race against these bots and spammers. So that's the type of disinformation that should be taken down, is inauthentic fake accounts who are running some sort of campaign. But that, and if that's where disinformation had stopped, it would have been fine. But once they had created this category or word, they now try to shoehorn into it.
Yeah.
Whenever somebody espouses a view that fundamentally they don't agree with. Mm-hmm. And so you saw this, I think, in the last election with the Hunter Biden story.
Absolutely.
Is that what happens? A month before the election, the New York Times runs a story about Hunter Biden's business dealings in Ukraine. And somehow they've gotten a hold of his laptop. The laptop is authentic. It's been completely authenticated by now. Even today, recently, the New York Times and the Washington Post have come out and said it was authentic. But this story was potentially damaging to the, you know, to the Biden campaign. Now, the employees of sites like Facebook and Twitter are extremely partial to their candidate. But if they just came out and suppressed the story, mm-hmm. because, you know, because they said, hey, this is our candidate, we want him to win, that wouldn't be acceptable to anybody. It would be naked partisanship. So what happens? They suppress it as disinformation. How do they do that? Well, what happens is how the process works, is that the campaign goes out and they go to, you know, basically partisan hacks like, you know, Clapper and Brennan, basically former, you know, security state
who operatives. MSNBC contributors.
Who are MSNBC contributors now, exactly. Yeah, they're partisans, right? But they stand to benefit if, you know, if a Democrat wins, because they can go back into running the CIA or NSA or what have you. And so these guys didn't know, but they create a letter, okay, that they got a bunch of these guys to sign. And what the letter said is, they couldn't say the laptop was inauthentic or that this was somehow Russian disinformation. They just said it had all the hallmarks of Russian disinformation. So they didn't know, but they say that, right? And so now, because they've written a letter and supposedly they're the experts, mm-hmm. then the New York Times writes a story basically endorsing, hey, this Hunter Biden story is Russian disinformation. And then the social networks take that and said, oh, well, this is disinformation. We have to suppress it. So what's happened is that you start with something that might be legitimate, which is we're going to ban inauthentic fake accounts on social media. And then basically that like idea gets gamed and hacked by political partisans to then use it as a grounds for censorship.
Yeah.
And that's how they basically suppressed the Hunter Biden story. Now, regardless of what you think about that story, the American people, and look, I didn't think that much about it at the time it came out. I read it. I didn't like that they were showing photos of him, and I thought that was sort of scurrilous and unnecessary.
Sure.
But the American people had a right to take that into account. And especially now that we're involved in a war in Ukraine, it seems like that.
Pretty relevant.
That seemed pretty relevant. So that was completely out of bounds for social media to be censoring the New York Post, which, by the way, the oldest newspaper in America, founded by Alexander Hamilton. It just shows you how far, you know, afield we've gotten on freedom of speech and the press.
And I think it's also because there's both, you know, in terms of whether or not these platforms should be either have a moral imperative or just a practically should be authorized to determine what is true and what is not. And you could look at it on principle and say, well, who are they to determine what's true or false? Here's the other part. In trying to, their track record on it is very bad. It's terrible, in fact. To the extent that they've tried to put their thumb on the scale and played fact checker, it's you can look at it and it doesn't seem like they're equipped to do it, even if you could theorize that they'd be good at it. Practically, their track record hasn't been good. And to put that in that amount of power in their hands is really dangerous, particularly when they're doing deliberately and knowingly what they seem to accuse everybody else of.
Right. And if you look at this new they're trying to create now a disinformation governance board at Homeland Security. So basically, this is a Ministry of Truth. And who do they appoint to that role? So a woman named Nina Jankowicz, who Mayorkas, the head of Homeland Security, says is a disinformation expert. Now, what exactly qualifies her to be a disinformation expert? This is somebody who argued for suppressing the Hunter Biden story that we just talked about because it was Russian disinformation. It wasn't. It's been completely authenticated as true. Mm-hmm. We all know that now. So she was wrong about that. Meanwhile, she was aggressively pushing the Steele dossier against Trump, which turns out to have been completely false. That actually was disinformation.
Laughably.
That was a completely false document created by a former British spy on behalf of a political campaign.
Oh yeah, he was being paid. It was part of oppositional research.
That's right. Exactly. Crazy. And for which people are now under indictment. Yeah. So you would think that these blemishes on her record of calling things disinformation that are actually true and pushing things that are actually false, you would think that would be disqualifying. But in the view of the people who are appointing her, those things are actually qualifications. Because when they talk about disinformation, what they really want is the power to suppress the other side, parts of the debate they don't like. And when they can label something as disinformation, as we've seen, then the social networks have a justification for removing it. Mm-hmm. So this whole thing, why would they create a disinformation governance board? It's so Orwellian. It sounds like a Ministry of Truth. The reason is they want an authority to bless anytime there's an opinion they don't like. They can get Nina Jankowicz to go out there, the expert on disinformation. Oh. She then calls it disinformation. And then Twitter and Facebook have a justification for removing that content from social networks. That is basically the path that we're on. And we saw that exactly with the Hunter Biden story. Mm-hmm. Now it's gotten to the point where, again, anytime that one side of the debate or the political spectrum doesn't like a point of view, they just label it disinformation. Listen, it's fine to disagree with it. It's fine to say you don't know what you're talking about. That's false. Let me prove it. You know, here's the real facts. Here are the receipts. That's the way the debate should work, is if you disagree with someone, say so and try to prove what the facts are.
The way it's worked for centuries.
Exactly. But that's not what they're interested in doing, because they're not interested in labeling you false and proving it. They're interested in labeling you disinformation. Why? Because that ends the debate.
Yeah.
When the other side gets labeled as disinformation, it shuts down the debate. And this is the point, is that we have a large contingent of people in this country on a certain side of the debate, basically on the sort of hard progressive left, and they're not interested in persuading anybody anymore. They're just interested in ending the debate. And when you have the power to define what is disinformation, you have the power to end the debate. That's what this is all about.
Mm-hmm. And so going back to the question of why, how did we end up where we are right now? And I think this is interesting. You alluded to it earlier, that there was a kind of fractional version of this during the early 90s, at least culturally, called political correctness, that there is a certain kind of enforced sensitivity and, this was a less formal, it was more informal imposition of a speech code that, you know, you would get, you gain social censure for running afoul of this, being politically incorrect. Okay. And that turned out to just be a brief phase. It sparked during the late 80s, drifted into the early 90s, and by the mid 90s was a distant memory. A lot of people, as I started to notice the kind of version two early in the 2010s, and all of a sudden, it seems that you can get a lot. They're trying to really increase the list of things that you can't say and the punishments that you can get. I had a lot of friends of mine, particularly ones that were a few years older, than a little more of age during the early 90s, say, okay, it's just, don't worry about this. It's just a phase. The pendulum will swing back. It was not just a phase. The pendulum did not swing back. This continued to go further and further to a place that was unforeseen, that very few people could have imagined, let's call it 8 years ago. Why do you think that is? How do you think that the guardrails of American society, where everyone, kind of accepted that while you certainly there can be some cultural and political hostility, that we are just, the notion of moderation and censorship was so wholly un-American that we would never get to this place, but yet we have. Do you have any theories on why that is, just from a cultural perspective?
Well, it's like what Andrew Sullivan famously said, we all live on campus now. So political correctness didn't stop. The people who were doing it graduated. and that now they occupy the high grounds of all of our professional institutions. So, you know, fundamentally, the big, I think, political and cultural divide in America is now between, it's no longer this sort of old right versus left. It's really about sort of populist versus elitist. And we can talk more about what that means. But basically, you've got a huge divide between what the professional class thinks, sort of the elite, and what the working class thinks. And if you read political scientists like Roy Tuchera, he really details this on his Substack. It's really worth checking out. But basically, polling shows that the professional class, those with college degrees, have radically different views than what the working class has in this country. And that is the fundamental tension. Now, the working class is about 2/3 of the country. The elites, the professional class, is only about 1/3. So the working class has the numbers, which in a democracy should ultimately prevail. But the elites control all of our institutions. And so, you know, if they control the Fortune 500, they can control the think tanks and the foundations and really the Democratic Party. So not just political, but also economic institutions. This is why the Fortune 500, you have this phenomenon of woke capitalism. There's not really that much difference between the views expressed by, you know, Disney or Netflix or the Democratic Party leadership or the New York Times or Washington Post. They're all sort of in lockstep. And, you know, Matthew Iglesias wrote about this several years ago. He called it the Great Awakening, where he pointed out that he described it, I think, as largely a good thing in his view, because he's sort of on the left side political spectrum.
But he's a bit of a skeptic.
Yeah, exactly. So, but what he recognized is that you had this sudden convergence of ideology among all these different institutions, whether it was the media, Hollywood, the nonprofit world, the Fortune 500. And it was sort of now, how do you get something like that? How do you get all of these institutions converging on the same ideology at the same time? It can't just be, you know, the way that, for example, I discovered my politics, where, you know, I went to college and I read a lot of stuff and I sort of figured out where I fit in the political spectrum. I sort of, you know, that's not the process. That you don't get a great cultural convergence like we're talking about. It only happens as a result of a class dynamic where you have basically this this sort of woke professional class. They've been inculcated at the universities and they've now graduated and gone to all these institutions and they run them. And this is fundamentally the divide in America now it doesn't mean that every single person with a college degree is left-wing or woke, but by the same token, it doesn't mean every single working class person is sort of more traditionalist, but basically those are the fault lines. And
And so I'd like to pose that there's one sub fault line there, because once again, the people who were on college campuses in 1992, they did graduate, but when they were in their 20s, and let's call it their late 20s, early 30s, they didn't seem to push as much cultural weight as the workers in the mid-level tech, those who were in college, let's call it late 2000s, early 2010s, seem to at media and technology companies on this day and age. And I think it's a dynamic that you're seeing, which it seems like a lot of woke capital is being driven by the tail wagging the dog, mid-level employees bullying the boss and the C-suite, right? You know, on All In, you guys had on the other day Brian Armstrong, who he might have been kind of the first salvo, you know, and aiming towards Elon and telling his employees, it's nice if you want to talk politics, that's not what we do here. If you're determined to talk politics, here's a nice severance package, take care. So this, I guess, is it, do you think that it is, it's both a class divide and a unique phenomenon of who is hired and who is staffed at these companies that speak to people, that control channels of communication, that graduated from college in the 2000s and the 2010s, that even have a far more left-leaning worldview than, you know, liberal, highly academic students who might have graduated in 1994, for instance.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you've now got multiple generations. I mean, when I went to college, I graduated in the early 90s. So, geez, that was almost, 25 years ago, or around 25 years ago. I remember in the late 80s, early 90s, we were having debates about the canon, about what the core you know, education at Stanford would represent. And that was when they got rid of the Western Civilization course. They kind of threw that out and replaced the, you know, the so-called dead white males, like, you know, Shakespeare and Plato and so forth, you know, all the traditional great thinkers of Western civilization. They got rid of all of that education. They replaced it with something different. And since then, we've now had multiple generations grow up with this sort of illiberal education. And so, yeah, it, that this basically is the, I think this is fundamentally the root cause, is that our profession, the institutions in the United States are run by people with college degrees, and they are all downstream of the university system. And the universities were captured two generations ago by radical leftists. And that's basically the education you get. Now, I think that that probably is a little bit too simplistic in the following way. I think there's basically three reactions you can have to the fact that universities now are completely run by sort of radicals. So one is you can get indoctrinated. You can basically become a true believer. The second is, and I'd say about 20%, my estimation is about 20% fall into that category. Okay. The second category is more like a go along to get along type. They basically, they sort of are, maybe they don't fully imbibe it. They, but maybe they're somewhat sympathetic to it, but they're not going to like fight it. And that's probably about 79%. And then the third category is what I call the rebels. And they're about 1%. And these are people who reject it. And so, okay, so now what happens to these people after they graduate? So the true believers go to do the jobs where, frankly, they don't pay that well. They basically don't pursue money. They pursue power and influence. So they do jobs like going to be reporters at the New York Times. That's sort of the dream job. Or, you know, or they go work at a foundation or something, or directly work on political campaigns. Or frankly, they staff the HR departments of large corporations. I mean, basically, they occupy centers of power in our culture that don't necessarily pay well. The second category, the go-along types, or, you know, call them collaborators, they tend to just go for the well-paying corporate jobs. So they're going to work at Goldman Sachs or McKinsey, or work their way up the ladder in the, you know, Fortune 500. That's basically what they do. And so when they then become the CEOs of these companies, they may not be activists, but they're sympathetic to that agenda. And of course, all the pressure is on them from the sort of the true believer types who have, you know, who can write the New York Times hit piece now, or they can organize the employee boycott or letter writing campaign, right? So they basically then give into that. And then, like I said, this third group, the rebels, they tend to go off and either they become sort of contrarian media. Maybe they go become a podcaster or like a, you know, Rogan or something, or they work at National Review. So you sort of have that type, conservative media, or just independent media, or they become founders or small business owners. And if you look at sort of founders, you know, they're not all rebel types, but they're significantly overweighted towards rebel types. It might even be as much as like 50-50 are sort of like, you know, Brian Armstrong, who you mentioned, or people who just have a very independent mindset and contrarian mindset and don't automatically embrace everything. And then probably about 50% are more traditional, more of the second category, the go-along types. But because of that, you know, this is why, you know, Peter Thiel has been one of the most successful venture capitalists over the past 20 years, despite having politics that are wildly at odds and being very outspoken about it from the rest of sort of this world we're talking about, is because the rebel types are so overrepresented in this sort of founder category. But of course, they don't all become tech founders. Many become small business owners. They want to work for themselves. They don't really want to subject themselves to working at a large corporation.
They rate high for disagreeableness, and that doesn't always, that does not work well when you're going up the corporate ladder. So right. Speaking of that, to that point, okay, and this Elon buying Twitter is a bit of a bomb in this range, right? So what's the blast radius? This is what I'm contemplating right now. Okay, he goes ahead and cleans up Twitter, rolls back the trust and safety committee, gets rid of the bots, and fires, you know, some of the woke mid-level employees who might be kind kind of exerting some internal pressure. Does that translate to Facebook and Instagram? Does that translate to some of the other tech companies that have been creeping in the direction of, as you mentioned, you know, implementing a de facto social credit system?
Right.
As you know, another disruptor, Vitalik Buterin, founder of Ethereum, and he kind of postulated that the largest consequence of Elon taking over Twitter may not be any specific policy decisions, but rather the morale effect of his supporters feeling emboldened and his detractors feeling like they're arguing on enemy territory. So, okay, if does that boost in morale kind of empower some of the other founders who are still running those companies and tech executives to move in this direction and kind of disregard the internal pressures that they're getting, you know, for more censorship?
I think so, because like we talked about at the beginning, there's so much inertia, or there was so much inertia to this movement where more and more categories of speech, more and more categories of opinion and thought were basically being put in the wrong thing category, were being described as disinformation and censored. So this wave of censorship was growing, it was galloping, and now it's hit its first serious patch of resistance, Elon saying no. And so even if he just stops it from getting any worse, that would be a significant accomplishment. But I also think that he can set an example here where if Twitter now affords users due process, if it affords them transparency into content moderation decisions, if he shows that, no, listen, we're going to allow people free speech, but it's not going to turn into a cesspool. That's nonsense. So he can then prove that a lot of these concepts work, and it will create pressure, I think, on the other companies to do likewise. So I do think it's very, very threatening to the forces of censorship that you have here, you know, one of the top entrepreneurs, world's richest man, willing to take a strong stance against it. And now, look, he hasn't bought Twitter yet. It's the deal is not done. So we have to hope it still gets consummated and then he's able to implement his vision. But I think it could be very transformational. And, you know, one of the things I described when you know, Trump was first thrown off social media, you had the censorship, you had the deplatforming of a sitting president of the United States. And I described it as a speech cartel, because what happened is all these companies got together at the same time to make the same decision.
Yeah.
And if they had done that for the purpose of price fixing, we absolutely, everyone would have been up in arms. But they got together for the purpose of speech fixing, where they all got together to decide, hey, we got to throw this guy off here. And that's basically what they've been doing, is they've all come together in like a cartel and agreed on a certain set of rules that which are constantly morphing in more of the censorship direction. And it felt like no one could break the cartel. And so sometimes it just takes one actor to break the cartel. And now if the other companies keep going in this direction of kicking people off, Twitter actually might do better and better. Those other sites might stagnate, whereas Twitter might have a market opportunity, and that might provide some check on bad behavior by the other members of the cartel.
Yeah, Twitter's always kind of been looked down upon from a financial perspective, somewhat so. And I mean, had they been optimizing the financial wherewithal of the platform and revenue opportunities, you know, maybe Elon would have never had the opportunity in the first place. So, you know, perhaps it regardless of morale and intangibles, and from a tangible perspective, they see economic success through a more, you know, open platform, which is clearly, you know, where Elon's mind is at. That would really lead the charge there.
And we'll have more of the prevailing narrative after the break.
Aside from free speech and the, you know, implications of Elon taking over Twitter and whatnot, one topic that you've been focused on quite a bit is the political economy and the politics in, you know, in where you've lived, primarily San Francisco and the state of California. Another atmosphere that is rife for some fixing and some reversal here. We've got California. Even today, the New York Times published a piece kind of acknowledging that California had net outflow migration for the first two times in recorded history the last 2 years. Clearly, there's something wrong with the governance of our state, and it's leading to a reduction in quality of life. Before we get into how to fix it, once again, how, you know, from your perspective as a Californian and someone who is deeply invested in fixing it out here, How do you think we got here? How did California, once again, you know, we've always accepted that it's a more liberal leaning state, but the liberal governance for all of its faults in the 90s, 2000s, and even into the early 2010s, whatever the results of that were, it did not lead to a very obvious decline in life quality that we're seeing now that is animating people to leave the state. So what happened in recent times that led us from whatever was going on in the 2000s to the Chesa Boudin, George Gascon, progressive overreach, dysfunctional era that we seem to be living in now here?
I mean, it's a great question. And I think there's so many things that have gone wrong in the state of California that it's hard to identify just one thing, but probably the root cause, if you had to identify just one thing, is that we live in a one-party state, effectively. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Republican Party has just not been competitive or effective for many years. I mean, who was the last Republican governor? I guess we got was Schwarzenegger, but that was quite a while ago. I don't think we have a single Republican elected statewide. They're just not even competitive. And of course, you know, single party states don't tend to do well.
Nobody keeping them honest.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's a huge problem. And I think it would be, you know, somebody needs to figure out how to reform the Republican Party in California, make it more competitive. Mm-hmm. But also people in California need to be, I think, more willing to look to alternatives. And so far, it's just been a one-party state. And then within that party, if you look over the last several years, the sort of radical progressive wing, basically the DSA socialist wing of the party, has become absolutely ascendant. And so, and you saw this, you know, several years ago, I think back in 2018, I supported Newsom. I donated to Newsom because he seemed like a sort of business friendly, socially liberal, more liberal Democrat. As mayor, he had supported marriage equality. He had supported decriminalization of cannabis, but he had also been business friendly. This is as mayor of San Francisco. Those were all issues that
at that time, those issues alone, being on the right side of those issues had value because not everybody was on the right side of those issues,
right.
And other right. issues of, you know, more, let's call it, issues of quality of life, like crime, homelessness, and whatnot.
Right.
Nobody was really concerned about it. I mean,
I guess what
my theory is that things got really good and for so long in California, and you add that to the state's natural advantages, that really critical issues just fell by the wayside because nobody figured you'd had to worry about them. Then
right.
a couple years of dysfunction plus the conditions of the pandemic, and all of a sudden real material reality it starts to become an issue, and you realize
right.
that these people simply are not equipped.
Yeah. And you know, I was sort of giving the reasons why I supported Newsom several years ago. The reality now, I would very much like to see somebody else win, because I just think that the last several years have been a disaster. And I think the big reason is simply because he's moved so far to the left. He has not, as it turned out, be the sort of centrist Democrat that we hoped he would be. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, let's just identify some of the hot button issues that are just a total disaster. Number one, homelessness. You know, we've got over 150,000 homeless people living unsheltered in California. His policies towards that have been completely ineffectual. Mm-hmm. He's been promising for over 10 years that he would end homelessness. He hasn't. It's only gotten worse. The ideas there are all wrong. And I'm sure you've had Michael Schellenberger on your show.
I'm talking with him. He's a little busy right now, but we definitely got Mike lined up.
Okay, that'd be great. I mean, he can speak to this in more detail than anybody else. And of course, he's running as independent for governor, and I'd love to see him win. So you've got the issue of homelessness. You've got the issue of crime, which has basically been caused by these decarceral DAs. Mm-hmm. You've got in San Francisco, you've got Chesa Boudin, and in LA, you've got George Gascon. And they literally think their job is to release as many criminals from prison as possible. They call their agenda decarceration.
Yeah. Magical thinking that somehow by releasing more criminals, you get less crime.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's almost as if having a DA who doesn't believe in putting people in prison, it's like having a fire chief who doesn't believe in water.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I don't want to over-incarcerate people, but there are violent repeat offenders who need to be put in prison to protect the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And they are letting these people go. And it is having tragic consequences. I mean, we've had so many people in San Francisco, just one city here. There have been many, many people who have died mm-hmm. as a result of violent repeat offenders being released from prison. The issue that got me alerted to this was the New Year's Eve killings of two women, Hannah Abe and Elizabeth Platt, by a repeat offender named Troy McAllister, mm-hmm. who was released by Chase Boudin as a third strike offender. Boudin becomes DA, releases him. He's arrested five more times before New Year's. Mm-hmm. He's released every single time, not charged. And then on New Year's Eve, he ends up killing these two women. It's just absolutely tragic. But there's a lot of examples like this. I mean, this has become really extreme. And now the thing that people don't understand that they should about Gavin Newsom is he's not out there on the stump, you know, with decarceral rhetoric like a Chase Boudin, like a George Gascon, but he is allied with them.
Yes.
And if you look at the personnel or policy and the personnel he's appointing, he had the ability to appoint anybody to the attorney general role in California. Once, I guess, Alex Padilla took over the Senate seat, he appointed a guy named Rob Bonta, who is a diehard, steadfast ally of Chase Boudin and George Gascon. If you go back and look, when Newsom appointed Bonta, they were delighted. They were, you know, so happy. So now you've got at the statewide level, you have basically someone pursuing decarcerationist policies mm-hmm. at the state level, just like Boudin and Gascon are pursuing at the city level. You also have Newsom signing bills to reduce punishments. You know, he was in favor of was it Prop 47?
Yeah,
that basically downgraded, you know, thefts of
essentially decriminalized anything under $950, was authorized by Gascon, and right. Newsom has been a patron and a backer of Gascon. He inserted Gascon by his discretion as the DA in San Francisco. Gascon, who had never been a lawyer before. He was a cop right. who got a law degree, and Gavin Newsom went ahead and installed him as district attorney. And it just goes back and, you know, mind boggling that this could all be happening right in front of everyone's face. And the right. California voters just seem to let it happen. It's a crazy thing. And the problem, as you mentioned with Newsom, is beyond the specific policies he enacts. It's what he doesn't enact. It's that he doesn't right. seem to acknowledge there's anything wrong. Is that he wants to continue to frame this state as a progressive wonderland where everything is going very well. Thus, because if he acknowledges that there's an issue, then somehow he has betrayed the notion that you know these progressive principles lead to, you know, to a great society. And it's like, come on, man. At some point, you got to realize like the people in your state are hurting. There's things going wrong.
Exactly. I mean, I remember during the recall, there was that day where he went out and started clearing trash under a freeway overpass or whatever. And he said, you know, these homeless encampments are unacceptable, you know, and then remember at the train tracks
yeah.
where, you know, you had like thousands of packages which had been stolen. He's like, who did this? This is unacceptable. Who did this? It's like, well, you did. You're the governor.
Yeah. Who's the governor? Check that again.
Right. Exactly. You know, so it's not enough to express disapproval of the situation. You're the governor. You have to do something about it. And yeah. if homeless encampments are unacceptable, clear them, clear them, you know, provide alternatives and clear them. Same thing with, you know, this, you know, if it's unacceptable for thousands of packages to be stolen off these train cars, well, restore punishment for that. I mean, like you said, with Prop 47, which he supported, first it downgraded all these property thefts to misdemeanors. And then you've got DAs like Boudin and Gascon, who simply don't prosecute misdemeanors.
Yes.
So effectively, this is why like shoplifting and property theft has been decriminalized mm-hmm. in California, because there's just no punishment. And the thing that these guys don't seem to understand is that when you decriminalize a behavior like that, it becomes more common.
Yeah.
It becomes more frequent. The number of crimes is not static. It depends on the incentives. And when you remove any deterrence, the number of crimes grows. And I mean, the amount of theft and burglaries and home break-ins now, I mean, it's out of control. Just talk to anybody in the state. They've all got their story. You know, you can't park your car
yeah.
anywhere in San Francisco anymore without having your window shattered and it broken into. And, you know, I wish there could be an effective alternative who could mount a campaign against Newsom, because I just think there's a lot of latent discontent out there.
Absolutely. It's kind of weird. You know, you and I, we had touched base during the recall, and it seemed like there was any number of polls that seemed to at least give some inkling that a lot of people were dissatisfied with his rule and with how the state was going. And yet he trounced him. It's hard really to find the cause and effect there that, okay, you can imagine that he would survive the recall, but to survive it by such a wide margin was odd, but maybe that could have been the particularities of that situation with nobody with an interesting defense. Do you think Mike Schellenberger has just been doing phenomenal work because he is speaking clearly and unapologetically about these failures and not in a sensationalistic, fire-breathing Republican way like Larry Elder did, and noting, no, right, Here's what's going wrong and here's how it can be fixed, and people should be holding Gavin Newsom accountable for not taking these very easy steps to fix it. Do you think that he's got any shot to, you know, whether or not to beat Newsom in November, to at least gather enough steam and enough attention that he can highlight the failures of the California political class, Gavin Newsom, and what needs to change?
Well, I think at a minimum, he can draw attention to these huge problems and the way to solve them. But I actually think, I know this is like a huge underdog sort of chance, but I think there is a scenario, which is, mm-hmm, California has a jungle primary where the top two finishers go to a runoff. And so it's sort of one big primary with all the Democrats, all the Republicans in there. So we know one of them will be Newsom. The question is, who's the number two? So, mm-hmm, normally it's the leading Republican, but, you know, if you get multiple Republicans running and they split the vote, it's conceivable that if Schellenberger just gets the second most votes, he'd be in the runoff against Newsom. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in a heads up situation, anything could happen. I think, you know, because then Schellenberger would get enough sort of earned media, free media attention that people could become more aware of him. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that he's not a Republican, frankly, could be an advantage because, yeah, in the state of California, you know, it's a 2-to-1 party affiliation in favor of Democrats over Republicans. And, you know, Republicans having that label is a little bit of a scarlet R in this state. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Schellenberger is an independent, I think, could be an advantage if he could just get to the runoff. Yeah. Because, again, he could get all the independents and all the Republicans and then maybe even some Democrats. So, you know, it's an outside sort of possibility, but I do think it is possible.
Mm-hmm. And so, and one of my theories on, okay, what can we do about California is that people need to start thinking more locally, that in the flaw with the Newsom recall attempt is that the attempt to, you know, to reverse course in California started too big, that the machine behind Newsom was so large, was so powerful, had so much money and was hard to draw, you know, that you're starting off to, you need to break it down into chunks and become more localized, that focusing on a mayor's race here, a recall of a DA there, city council, is a far more effective way to do it. And that given the dissatisfaction of so many more traditionally Democratic or progressive knee-jerk California voters, that this can be done. And there's starting to be some evidence that that is the case. I think you guys up in San Francisco have mounted a couple recalls. One was an interesting one against three radical school board members, was very successful and showed that the most progressive San Francisco voters will at some point have their breaking point. You've got the Chesa Boudin recall to a vote, that you gathered enough signatures. I believe his recall vote is coming on June 7th. How is that shaping up?
I think it's shaping up very well. I mean, I think the people of the city are fed up with it. I mean, they can, mm-hmm, see the problem. And I mean, here's the thing. If you can just get people out of their political tribes, mm-hmm, then you can actually get them to vote for change. And so, for example, with the school board, and this is true of the Boudin recall as well, it's the mayor who gets to appoint the replacement. So you have a straight up or down vote against, it was first the school board, and we won that by 78%. Now it's going to be Boudin. I think we're going to win that too. I think he will be recalled. And it'll be London Breed who will appoint the successor. She's, mm-hmm, a Democrat. The replacement's going to be a Democrat. So they try to run against, you know, the Republican recall, or they try to, yeah, run against Trump or whatever. It has nothing to do with this. It's not partisan. And I think most of the people living in San Francisco, they can see the problem. They saw the problem with their schools. They can see the problem with crime. They want something done about it. And again, I think if you just get people out of their political tribes, I think they'll vote for change. Now, the thing that Newsom was effective at doing last year was basically stirring up sort of political tribalism. So if you go back, mm-hmm, to last summer, there was that shock poll for a week where Newsom was down by 10, you know, and it was before there was any, before Republicans had sort of congealed around a single candidate, you know, Larry Elder, when it was just sort of a blob of replacement candidates, Newsom actually was looking pretty vulnerable because people do want an alternative, I think. But then what happened is that the field sort of consolidated around Larry Elder, and Newsom was very effective, rightly or wrongly, at portraying Elder as some sort of Trump clone, which I think is a little bit ridiculous, but that's what he was successful at doing. And look, I mean, Trump lost California by 30 points. No one in California wants a Trump. That's just a reality. And so, you know, when these politicians can try to portray their opponent as, you know, when they can sort of nationalize the election and make it about, you know, something that really has nothing to do with California, quite frankly, that's how they stay in power. So you're right. If we can get people to think a little bit closer to home, that's how you can get maybe get some change.
No doubt. And as you mentioned, the national issues, the of kind of low relevance influencing California elections. One of the issues that popped up during the recall was a ruling or at least a Governor Abbott of Texas signing off on some pretty restrictive laws around abortion that was then weaponized by California politicians. Obviously, this weekend, big news around the abortion issue with a leaked preemptive opinion, a majority opinion essentially overturning Roe v. Wade. And you can already see Newsom already did a Planned Parenthood event today, and Karen Bass is already LA mayoral candidate Karen Bass already pointing to the abortion issue, even though anyone who's done even a scintilla of investigation or research on this issue knows there's no way the overturning of Roe v. Wade will impact abortion rights in California. The legislature will encode those rights. But what do you think? Do you think that it's going to work? Do you think that the concerns about the overturning of Roe v. Wade may, you know, kind of pump the brakes on some of that wind change here in California? And if you have any other thoughts on the ruling in general.
Yeah, I think it could in the way that you're saying. So first of all, people have really deeply held personal feelings about that topic, and I'm not going to say anything to change their minds.
No doubt.
You know, I think the thing that people just have to understand is that what that decision means, assuming that it actually becomes the law of the land, I guess there's some question. It's a leaked opinion. It hasn't taken effect yet. But what it basically does is it hands the issue back to the states. Yeah. So every state can determine its own policy. And as you said, regardless of what Mississippi or Texas or Oklahoma end up doing, we know what California is going to do.
Yeah.
You know, the right to choose is extremely popular in California. Newsom's already talking about turning that into a constitutional amendment. Whether you do that or not, the state's going to stay a pro-choice state.
Yeah.
And I saw that, you know, Rick Caruso, who's running against Karen Bass in L.A. for mayor, came right out right away and said, listen, I'm pro-choice. You know, there's going to be no restrictions on abortion on my watch, and which I think is the politically smart thing to do. So the bottom line is that this is a issue that people feel really strongly about, but it's a national issue, and it's just not going to have any impact on the law in California. But nonetheless, this is what Newsom is going to want to talk about, because if he can kind of, you know, it's a deeply emotional issue for people. And if he can basically get people to focus on this, as opposed to homelessness or crime or the schools or taxes or the fact that a couple hundred thousand people are leaving the state every year, it's a winning issue for him.
Yeah, he's going to be able to deflect from his failures and kind of, you know, get people to vote based on those tribal instincts as opposed to the you know, their material concerns right in front of their face. Another interesting political development, this is actually last night, and around a individual that you had been involved with and thrown a fundraiser for. It's a gentleman named J.D. Vance. And at first glance, just a Republican a primary for senator, but this seems to make larger national news. J.D. Vance is an interesting character that reflects some of the a response to the divide that you mentioned earlier between the working class, which constitutes two-thirds of the voting citizens in this country, and the elite, in that J.D. Vance is a highly educated individual, member of the elite tech world, venture capitalist, but who has, you know, almost become what some people would call a class turncoat in speaking very, you know, vocally against how elite culture has kind of degraded or dismissed the concerns of working class individuals in somewhat of a Trumpy way. Would be interested in your thoughts on why, you know, why J.D. Vance is a significant candidate and what is unique and new about him, and, you know, as he's being labeled a member of the so-called new right. What values or what positions or what composition of values and positions does J.D. Vance and the new right seem to carry that is, you know, not something that we've seen in American politics in recent decades?
Yeah, I think what JD represents, the reason I support him is because I would like to see the Republican Party become more of a working class party. Mm-hmm. And, you know, JD wrote the book Hillbilly Elegy, and I think he speaks to the people who have been left behind in our great, you know, by our great technological economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a big part of the tech economy. And there's no question that tech is foundation to innovation, which makes America, it makes the American economy dynamic and robust. But there's also a lot of people who've been left behind. And I think it's important that Republicans have a message for those people. And I think JD represents an attempt to reach out to them by the party, and I support it. The other thing that I think, and I think, by the way, that he will be a thorn in the side of these large mega corporations, these big tech monopolies that are trying to take away our free speech rights or censoring us, that have become too monopolistic, too powerful, who actually are starting to get so big and powerful that they're squelching, they're stamping out the ability of startups to really challenge them. And actually, it's gotten to the point now where I actually think it's going to hurt our economy if we don't create some check and balance on them, some antitrust action against them. So he's a little bit of a different kind of Republican in that I think he will look more skeptically at the actions of these big tech monopolies, which I think is good. And then I think the final issue is on foreign policy. You know, I think American foreign policy over the last 20 years has gone very badly off the rails. We keep getting involved in these stupid foreign wars where, you know, we spent over the last 20 years, we spent $6 trillion on nation building in Afghanistan and Iraq. We spent 20 years in Afghanistan. It's America's longest war. We lost that war. Mm-hmm. The way in which we left was a debacle. You know, the Iraq war is a disaster. We ended up handing that country on a silver platter to Iran. Yeah. And now controls it through proxies. And then we had other interventions like Syria and Libya, where those countries are even worse off than they were before.
Yeah.
So American foreign policy really has been a disaster. And the root of the problem is we've been overly interventionist. We basically keep involving ourselves in parts of the world that we don't need to. And, you know, this has been a bipartisan affliction. Both Republicans and Democrats got us into those situations. And I think we need different kinds of politicians to go to Washington to maybe sort this out. But JD, I think, has been very clear about these are stupid wars we should not keep getting ourselves into.
And it seems to be an exuberance or an overestimation of what change we can affect in the world. Can we turn Iraq into a democracy or Afghanistan into a democracy? Can we overthrow, you know, is our intervention in essentially, you know, allowing for the murder of Gaddafi going to be a net plus for Libya? And no, Libya becomes a failed state with open air slave markets and that nobody talks about for some reason, right? And that seems to be this this fault by overestimation of our capabilities as supposedly the world's sole hegemonic power here seems to repeat itself. And another place where it's threatening to repeat itself seems to, that you've been commenting on is in the Ukraine with the Russia-Ukraine conflict that you've been, you know, speaking out about recently, in particular about the seemingly unwillingness of our foreign policy establishment and the Biden administration to search for a diplomatic solution, and that the labeling of any suggestion of a diplomatic solution being framed the same way as the conservatives in the Bush administration framed anyone who dared question the Iraq war as placating Saddam Hussein. And do you think that our missteps, or what you believe are missteps in the Ukraine-Russia conflict right now, as we're watching them in real time, do you think that they're being driven by our overestimation and our irrational exuberance that if we support the Ukraine enough, if this war drags on long enough, that Vladimir Putin will be overthrown?
I think the desire for regime change in Russia is a big part of our policy. And that's the part of our policy that I think is a mistake. Like you said, every attempt by America over the last 20 years to implement regime change has been a disaster. Yeah. We either end up with the same or worse. In Iraq, we took out Saddam. Okay, he was horrible, but now we have worse. Iran has been empowered.
Sure.
You know, Afghanistan, the Taliban are right back in control. Syria, Assad's still in power there. And then in Libya, like you said, we took out Gaddafi, and now there's anarchy. There's open air slave markets. So it always seems like when we go for regime change in these countries, we end up with, again, same or worse. Now,
yeah,
you know, Ukraine is a little different than the Middle East in the sense that at least we are not the foreign invader who's going in there. I mean, that is basically Russia. And in the same way that we were on the buzzsaw of nationalism, you know, we underestimated the nationalism of the Afghanis or the Iraqis. I think the Russians have underestimated the nationalism of the Ukrainians. And they're paying a very high price for that. And I think, look, we all sympathize with Ukraine and their desire for sovereignty and to be, you know, out from under Russian domination. So I think that providing some support for Ukraine makes sense based on our values. But what I'm concerned about is I think we have now defined the mission. And Biden basically said this, right? He basically said, we cannot allow Putin to stay in power. We've now, I think, defined the mission as destabilizing or toppling the Russian regime, basically weakening Russia. And the problem with that, I think, is it's a dangerous and open-ended mission that that could lead to something much worse, whether, you know, we get it's fundamentally escalatory.
Well, it's just Vladimir Putin doesn't seem like the type of guy, if he's going down, is not just going to try to take everybody else down with him.
Right. Right. Exactly. And we have now open conversations about, I mean, every pundit basically acknowledges the risk of World War III here. And a lot of them say we're already in it. But you have widespread talk among pundits now and in the news about the potential for a nuclear use in relation to the Ukraine war. And so that right there should tell you that something has gone sort of off the rails with our policy, because the fact of the matter is that no American president, not even Biden, has ever made the case that America has a vital national interest in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. We simply don't. No American president has ever asserted that. And so for us to be risking a potential nuclear use, if that could happen, over what's happening in Ukraine, there's a mismatch there in our policy objectives, are the amount of risk that we're taking in relation to what we have to gain. And what I've argued is that, first of all, we should have tried to avoid this war through negotiation. That we had opportunities last year to do that. The administration failed at that. They didn't really try. And now, again, they seem not to be interested in driving the process to a peaceful resolution, to a negotiated settlement. They just seem to, they're not even part of it. I mean, when there were peace talks last month, the mediators were people like Naftali Bennett from Israel or Erdogan from Turkey or Macron from France. The U.S. wasn't even present. And it seems like it's not an objective of this administration to bring the resolution, bring a swift resolution to this conflict as quickly as possible. It seems like, again, the objective is regime change in Russia. And I think that could end up being a, you know, fatal or really tragic miscalculation.
A miscalculation or one that simply does not net out as a plus for American society, that, you know, we're aiming when they're trying to aim for the stars, we might come up with a handful of mud, because it you know, Vladimir Putin has more to lose than we do, and he's going to act he's going to act rationally in alignment with that.
And we'll have more of the prevailing narrative after the break.
So one last topic here before I let you go and switch into the economy for a second, because another, you know, place, much like the free speech debate where you had skated to where the puck was going to be, was acknowledging that some of our recent economic troubles, and particularly amongst these in the startup world and tech stocks, tech companies and high growth companies, it wasn't just a you know, a quick correction at the end of Q4, early Q1. In February 3rd of this year, you mentioned, you expressed that you believed that we were already in a recession. That was a pretty unique point of view at such time. Everybody was still kind of a little bit high off the on the sugar high of low interest rates and free flowing cash from pandemic macroeconomic policies, and just assumed that the good times were going to keep on rolling, but we might have just been experiencing a little indigestion for a second. Seems that your pessimism has proven out. What informed your views at that time that this was something that was had more continuity as opposed to just being a short-term correction?
There were a bunch of canaries in the coal mine. So if you go back to November, the growth stocks started correcting in November. And by February, they were down significantly. And since February, they've gone down even more. And then we just had the news that in Q1, GDP actually shrank by 1.5%. So a recession is technically defined as two quarters of negative growth. We now had one quarter of negative growth. I think it's likely that Q2 will be negative as well, and then we'll officially be in a recession. So I think we are in a recession. And the, I guess, how did I know or how did I have that feeling? I could feel the slowdown on the boards of a lot of companies. And you know, we're investors in a lot of growth stocks. And growth stocks corrected first, because what happened is back in November, we finally had the Fed admit that inflation was not transitory. We had something like close to 8% inflation, and the Fed started getting very hawkish and announcing some major interest rate increases. So interest rate expectations started going up, and then that clobbered growth stocks. And if you look at, you know, growth stocks, recent IPOs, SPACs, and so forth, they're down about 80% over the last 6 months. I mean, we're talking about, you know, dot-com level crash here. And a lot of people who aren't in our sort of business may not have seen it, because they just look at like the indices, the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, and the big caps disguised what was happening in the small cap growth stocks, because they haven't gone down that much. Maybe they're down like 15% or something like that. So because the indices are so overweighted to the big caps, most people weren't really paying attention to what was happening in growth stock land. And my experience has been that when you get a correction, a massive correction, indicating the end of an asset bubble, you know, you never really know you're in a bubble until after the correction, but a recession almost always follows that, because you just can't have that much wealth getting wiped out without that eventually then leading to a slowdown in the economy. And then once everyone realizes that, the recession almost becomes self-fulfilling, because everyone starts pulling back. And, you know, all my discussions at board meetings now are like, how much should we slow spending so that we extend our runway? And so I think we're headed for a pretty nasty recession here, unfortunately. It's not something I want and by any means, but it feels like that's what we're headed for.
Yeah, no doubt. And one interesting factor of the kind of trajectory of the economy, you guys discussed it on All In, I think it was last week, and noticed in acknowledging that even with the with negative growth rate in the GDP during Q1, consumer sentiment and consumer spending and business spending was still accelerating, and that there's other factors that were driving down GDP and the engine of the U.S. economy, once and always, in particular in recent years, consumer appetite. Just Americans continue to buy stuff. They seem to have the capacity to buy stuff. And even if they don't, they find a way to do it. Is part of your negative outlook informed by inflation, consumer inflation, and also in particularly with, you know, with oil prices cutting into consumer budgets and kind of pumping some of the brakes on that consumer engine that's been driving a lot of, you know, public facing companies?
Yeah, I think the original sin here, the root cause of this downturn ultimately is inflation. And if you go back, what basically happened is in response to COVID, we had $10 trillion of money printing by Congress and by the Fed. And, you know, the first thing Biden did when he got into office was the last $2 trillion of COVID spending. And there were macroeconomists who warned at the time, Larry Summers, who's a prominent Democratic economist, warned, guys, I think this could be very inflationary. And he was roundly denounced by the administration, by Jen Psaki. You had, you know, famed investors like Stanley Druckenmiller come out and say, listen, we don't need the stimulus. Retail's already 15% above trend, meaning consumer demand is back. It's back above trend. It's well above. And so there were warnings, and yet the administration went ahead anyway. And passed along straight party line votes this last $2 trillion. And that money went through the economy. And of course, then we also had the infrastructure bill, which then was another $1.2 trillion. And by the way, they wanted more. Remember, they wanted $4 trillion for Build Back Better.
Yeah.
And, you know, Manchin and Sinema didn't give it to them. So that didn't pass. But because of all these trillions of spending, we then had inflation get out of control. And it started last summer. We got up to about, was it 5.2% last summer? But everyone said, oh, no, this is transitory. Don't worry about it. Then by the end of the year, we're up to 7.8%. And that's why the Fed felt like they had to crack down really hard. They had to jack up interest rates in order to control inflation. And then that led to this like massive stock market correction. And I think that now is being felt through the real economy. All these things, it's like dominoes falling one after another. And but the first domino to fall, I think, was this these last few trillion of spending that were pushed through that created the inflation. And the irony is that I think the administration thought that, hey, you know, if we basically just pump this $2 trillion through, it's going to buy us the midterms, right? Everyone's going to feel really good about getting these stimulus checks. And the problem is it backfired because, yeah, some people got stimulus checks and maybe they felt happy for a day, but you forget about that 2 years later when you're out of a job or your wages are worth a lot less because of inflation, you know, at the fuel pump or you go to buy food, you know, everything's twice as expensive. So I think their strategy really, I think it was somewhat cynical. They really thought that maybe they could buy this election, this midterm. And I think it actually backfired massively.
And so unnecessary, and that we were already 18 months into the pandemic, and that to the extent that the economy needed to recalibrate, it already had, right? And you saw that the consumer economy had held up very well. All these, obviously, there are some small businesses and some retail businesses in a variety of markets that simply rely on foot traffic, and they were hit pretty hard, and some of them didn't survive. But this whole notion that that we just experienced a first of its kind exogenous shock of a pandemic, and oh my God, we need to turn on the spigot, that was not a justifiable view 18 months into this thing. Instead, they just went for political reasons, and they just jumped it all in there.
Yeah, exactly. And you remember Biden ran promising a return to normalcy.
Yeah.
And if he had just given us normalcy, he'd be incredibly popular right now. What did normalcy mean? It meant ending all these crazy COVID mandates and COVID restrictions, getting life back to normal. That's what people desperately wanted. Mm-hmm. But he was very slow to do that. Instead, he tried to basically, you know, remember, he tried to impose this vax mandate on 100 million workers. The Supreme Court threw it out, found it unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So he didn't lead us back to normalcy on COVID. The states have mostly done that. The governors have mostly done that. On the economy, we were in the process of recovering. The economy was sensitive, but recovering. All he had to do was leave well enough alone. And instead, he jammed down this extra few trillion of spending, which we didn't need, and tried to get more, you know, and so on down the line. And so this is why he's at 37% approval rate. And then on Ukraine, I know it's popular to support Ukraine in this war, but the better approach would have been to avoid this thing altogether. And there were so many things the administration could have done last year to help prevent this war. And they never did those things.
Do you think taking NATO membership off the Ukraine NATO membership off the table, do you think that alone could have prevented this invasion? And that seems to be the point of contention for a lot of people.
Yeah. So that was the Russians' most longstanding demand, is that they were upset that Ukraine could become part of NATO. But all the way back in 2008, we had declared at this Bucharest summit of NATO that eventually that the door would be opened for Ukraine and Georgia to join NATO. And right away, the Russians said, this is a red line for us. You know, Ukraine is right there on their doorstep. They've been invaded multiple times throughout their history through Ukraine. And, you know, NATO sounds like a purely defensive organization to us. That's the way they see it. That's the way we see it. But from the Russian point of view, they see it as an offensive organization. And they didn't like the idea of being encircled on a 1,200-mile border by the United States. And if Ukraine becomes part of NATO, it meant American weapons, soldiers, and bases right there on their border. And they were having none of that. That basically has been their most longstanding demand. And if you go back and look at the contemporaneous press accounts, I went back and analyzed this question about how impactful was NATO expansion in this whole war. And what I would tell you is it was always the issue that the Russians had, that they were extremely, they expressed it publicly. You know, all you have to do is read the headlines and you will see in headlines by the Associated Press, Russia says this is a red line, over and over and over again. And so what you'd have to say, if you don't believe this was their number one issue, is that it was a pretext and that really they have some other issue like conquest or something like that. And this is all just something they've made up. But if it is something they've made up, they've been saying it for a long time. And my point of view is, look, I can't prove that it wasn't a pretext, because how do you know what's in Putin's head? But my view is that we should have robbed them of that pretext. And so what you do is you take that pretext off the table. If we had given them a written guarantee that Ukraine would not have been part of NATO, if Putin then invades, you've proved that he's a liar, you know, on this point. Yeah. And so then we know exactly what this conflict is about. But the problem is we never took the issue off the table. Mm-hmm. Now, we could have gotten something for that. I'm not saying you just give it up without getting something in return, but we could have negotiated that point. And the crazy thing is that Zelensky recently did an interview with Fareed Zakaria where he said that privately he was told that Ukraine could not become part of NATO, but that publicly we can't say that because we want NATO's door to remain open. So this was the diplomatic approach that we had, is that privately we told Ukraine you're not going to be part of NATO, but we were unwilling to publicly guarantee that to the Russians because we wanted to vindicate this supposed principle of the open door principle of NATO. That makes no sense to me. If you're telling Ukraine you're not going to be part of NATO, tell the Russians the same thing. Because again, you'll rob Putin of that pretext for an invasion. And if he moves ahead anyway, well, you've proven that he's a liar, but don't give him that pretext. By the way, that pretext has been popular with the Russian people. So if you look at polling of the Russian people before the invasion, by 2-1, they were willing to go to war to prevent Ukraine being part of NATO, but they were not in favor of going to war just to reunify, just for conquest. And so at a minimum, if you take that pretext off the table, you drive up Putin's negatives among the Russian people. And recently there was polling by a group called Levada Center's Independent Pollster, and they showed that Putin is still popular by like 80% in Russia. So his popularity went up. And so at a minimum, we should have driven up the cost to him of an invasion by not giving him the pretext that he wanted, if that's what it was. Mm-hmm. So I just think it was diplomatic malpractice. I mean, negotiators call this the giving someone the sleeves off your vest. It's giving them a concession that basically is meaningless to you. Like, if we were saying privately that Ukraine shouldn't have been, it wasn't going to be part of NATO, there was no downside in us saying that publicly. It was giving the Russians the sleeves off our vest, but we refused to do it.
It seems to me, I mean, it goes back, is related to my earlier point about, you know, overestimating our capabilities. Are we still, does the ruling class or the foreign policy establishment still just want to pretend that it's 1998, the Clinton Pax Americana, where we're just so overwhelmingly the most powerful nation on earth with no recent foreign policy blemishes on our record, and we can do anything, and thus we don't need to compromise or show weakness or give anyone a concession? And is that what's driving it? Because if not, it just seems completely irrational.
Well, I think Blinken and the State Department clearly were unwilling to close NATO's door to Ukraine publicly. They were not willing to make that concession, even though the Russians said it was the most important thing they wanted. And now you can argue that we could have made that concession and the Russians would have invaded anyway, but we don't know that because we never did make that concession.
Yeah.
And so you have to wonder, well, why was it so important to the State Department that we keep NATO's door open? By the way, NATO, we've already been through multiple rounds of NATO expansion. Just like, was it like 30 countries in NATO now?
I believe so.
Yeah. So we've expanded NATO a lot. And you got to remember that the way NATO works is NATO is an alliance where an attack on one is an attack on all. So if any NATO country is attacked, all the other NATO countries come to its defense. Well, the fact of the matter is that if the United States is attacked, Ukraine coming to our defense doesn't help us. You know, we're the ones with a huge military. It helps them. Mm-hmm. So the truth of the matter is that when a country joins NATO, we become responsible for their national defense. We don't really get anything out of it. They get a lot out of it. That's mm-hmm. why they all want to join NATO. But the reason why we were hesitant to let Ukraine join NATO, remember, we expressed the desire back in 2008. It didn't happen. Obama didn't do it. Trump didn't do it. The reason why multiple American presidents didn't want to do it is because Ukraine and Russia have issues and disputes going back hundreds of years. And we don't want to get drawn into those conflicts. We don't want to get drawn into a war with Russia because they get in a dispute with Ukraine. And so that is why we had never admitted them to NATO. And that policy made sense. And frankly, all this talk you hear right now about the potential for World War III and nuclear war is a preview of what it would be like to live in a world in which Ukraine was a member of NATO. Yeah. We'd be constantly worried about getting in World War III with Russia because of a dispute between Russia and Ukraine. And the only reason, by the way, that we don't have American boots on the ground right now, thank God, is because Ukraine is not a member of NATO. So my point is just admitting Ukraine to NATO would have been an incredibly foolish thing to do anyway. It's not something that any previous American president wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And yet the State Department refused to give that up in a negotiation. So we were vindicating the wrong principle to begin with. And I think if we had given it up, we might have changed the trajectory of this whole conflict.
Yeah. Well, that's the million-dollar question, right? If you're flipping a coin and considering, okay, was this just going to expose Putin as a pure bad actor who was going to invade no matter what? And it would have kind of at least changed some of the geopolitical calculus, if not the military calculus, or would it have prevented the intervention in the first place? It is a fascinating counterfactual, yeah. But it certainly does speak to, you know, the failings of our, or at least where, whether you want to call it, believe their failings or otherwise, where our foreign policy establishment is at. Last question on Russia. Do you believe any of the, you know, issues with the economy right now? I mean, I think it in terms of the uncertainty being drawn from this conflict had an initial impact on the economy and the stock market. Is that already priced in? Is the market still worried about Russia? Has it already forgotten about Russia?
I think that the current level of the conflict is priced in. But the problem is, I just think you can't price in some of the risks that we're talking about. So I guess the answer is, if the conflict were to spin out of control, no, I don't think it's priced in. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that a nuclear use in Ukraine is likely, but it's a possibility. And, yeah. You know, there are scenarios you could imagine where something like that could happen. And then we're in a whole different world.
Yeah.
And I think that the markets, it would be a disaster, basically. I think the markets would tank well beyond what's already happened. I think you'd be in a depression. I mean, then you really do have a new world order if you start getting tactical nuclear nukes being used on a battlefield. I mean, that would be a disaster.
That's
right?
A place and on the chessboard we've never seen before.
Yeah, exactly. And so do I think that's likely? No, it's not likely, but it's possible. And the fact that it would be so damaging and so negative means that you have to take it into account. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the administration's really thinking through that properly. Again, we're taking a lot of risks here, and I don't necessarily see the upside.
Yeah.
For those risks. I think what we should be trying to do is broker a negotiated peace. And, but the administration has been very hardline about this, and they don't seem interested in doing that.
Yeah, it's been strange. I mean, a lot of people were expecting it one way or the other for this Ukraine-Russia conflict to come to, you know, for us to get some semblance of a result pretty quickly. And once it faded from the immediate news cycle, it seems to just kind of be out there. It's almost like Afghanistan. It's just kind of out there far off in the distance. We know something's going on. Not a lot of people are paying as much attention to it. And you've got to wonder what the realistic off ramps are. But hopefully it is one that is both peaceful and one that is relatively not disruptive to our national interests here. David, we covered a lot of ground, got, you know, pretty far down the road in solving all the world's problems, California's problems, the internet's problems. It was a pleasure. I look forward to, you know, sure you guys will be monitoring these scenarios as we look to just how transformative Elon taking over Twitter will be, the shifting political winds in California, hopefully a relatively short recession or downturn in the economy. Just wanted to thank you so much for coming on today.
Hey, great to be here.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Matt.
My pleasure, everybody. This is The Prevailing Narrative.
I am Matt Belinsky. Once again, you can listen and subscribe to The Prevailing Narrative on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening right now. Make sure to follow me on my socials at Matt Belinsky, MattBilinsky. The Prevailing Narrative is a Cavalry Audio production in association with iHeartRadio. Produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Dana Brunetti and Keegan Rosenberger. For Cavalry Audio, I'm Matt Belinsky.